You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, you're listening to episode 60 of My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Tilly.
And I'm Ash.
And today, we are continuing our deep dive into the archaeology of Terry Pratchett's Discworld. Woof, woof, woof,
woof, woof. Very much a deep dive. I've got four pages of notes. I'm ready to go.
I don't think Ash realised what she got herself into.
I did not. I'm very much enjoying it so far, though.
I love how when we were talking about, like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do, like, the archaeology of, like, the Witcher and, like, all these sorts of things. And I was like, ha, I could do one about the archaeology of Discworld. And Ash was like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Little did she know. That would involve me just rambling on and on about
it's actually quite scary how encyclopedic your knowledge is of this world. Like, I can tell you this now, like, we have no notes. This is just Tilly. This is Tilly going for it, telling me everything, remembering names like she's been talking to them forever, which she probably has.
I've been talking to them since I was a teenager. Like,
yeah, they're just like in there.
Yeah. I think it's just, this is really my, like, comfort reads.
This is your,
like,
specialist subject.
It basically is. I could do Mastermind on Terry Pratchett's Discworld, I think.
Oh my god, you totally should.
I totally should.
We should do a Mastermind episode of Discworld for you. I will ask the really difficult questions.
Oh, you actually should. Maybe we'll do that as a live event.
That'd be fun.
That would be kind
of
fun.
Put you under pressure. I'll even get the music. I'll pay for it. Copyright.
Let's do that. Okay, listeners, if you want to attend a live event, keep an eye on our socials and the socials of the AP of the Archaeology Podcast Network, and we will do that. We should do that. I'm up for that.
Yeah.
That sounds good. But it's basically because, yeah, they're my comfort reads, so I read them.
That's good, though. Everyone needs a comfort read. Yeah. Everyone needs a comfort read.
Exactly.
But last episode, we left off talking about gods.
We did, yes. And they were a little bit upset because we stopped talking about them. I had a couple of lightning bolts at my house when I got home.
Yeah.
No.
The static energy is not helping my hair at all.
Yeah. So, the gods, it's funny though, actually, because there's some of the books that where the gods are more important, and then there's some where they're just not even really mentioned, or they're only kind of mentioned in passing. So it's... I think my favorite one, I keep referencing Going Postal just because it is a very good one, and we've talked about that a lot, and I know that you know it. So it says he has to go and give an offering to Offla the crocodile god, and this is Moise von Lipwig, who's the main character, and he goes and he takes some sausages to Offla the crocodile god, and the priest is there going like, ah yes, excellent, so we will cook these sausages. And Moise is going, ah yes, how does that work? And he's going, ah well, you know, they say that the smell of the sausages is better than the, you know, taste a lot of the time, right? Like, you smell sausages and you just think, oh, those are amazing. And so we then consume the shallow shell of the essence of the sausage. And really, the main soul of the sausage is going up into the sky, you know, for the gods. And he's like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, you're really, you know, martyring yourself here. And he's like, well, you know, do you want some ketchup with yours? It's sort of like whole thing. But yeah, so there are references to, like, all these different gods, and you have this very clear idea that the gods only exist if enough people believe in them, which is dealt with a lot in Small Gods, which is one of the books that we sort of talked about last episode as well, which I really think is interesting as a concept, because that's something that I think is also quite seen in, like, history and prehistory, is that you had, well, prehistory mainly, you sort of see a lot of fluctuation in
belief.
The different beliefs are happening.
Is there any gods that, like, disappear in Discworld and then another god kind of takes over because belief changes?
Yeah, like, and that's actually, so spoilers for Small Gods, the book, that's actually kind of the main premise of Small Gods, is because there's this one acolyte who's the one that the tortoise lands on the god, and it turns out he's then the only one who actually believes in Om still, and as he starts to fade at some point, then Om starts to fade away as well, and is going, wait, no, like, I can't, like, he used to be the most powerful god ever and everything. And it's also in Monstrous Regiment, which is a very good one. I would highly recommend that one if anyone just wants to start with, like, a one-off book without, and that, like, is very typically Pratchett and is a very fascinating story, but doesn't need much pre-reading. Start with Monstrous Regiment. It's about this small town. Oh God, I can't even remember what it's called. But it's again based on a sort of Eastern European country and their war with everyone else. But then it turns out that everyone else isn't really wanting to be at war with them. They're just like trying to get them under control, basically. And it's this whole thing. And there's the god and a duchess who's also the god, which I find quite interesting because that's then also similar to in a lot of other places with that belief of the king being like close to the god and everything. But then it's, yeah, she is dying as a god, but she still exists. And yeah, it's all very complex. Sorry, I realize I'm making no sense right now.
No, you was. She's dying as a god, but she's also still living as a human.
Other way around.
She's living
as a god.
She died
as a human, but she's still alive as a god because so many people believe in her that like she's continued to exist, which I find really fascinating.
It sort of reminds me of the book by Hannah Kana, God Killer.
Oh, right. Okay.
We talked about that again right at the beginning. And it was about belief and how basically people started to believe in different small gods. And then the main character goes around killing these gods. Gods. And it's like gods in water and in very elemental places that people are believing in. And they actually the gods can kill other people.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know. It just reminds me of that. The belief is how strong the god is.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, 100%. That's exactly the same on the Discworld.
I think there's a few different tropes like that. I'm pretty sure this is like such a TV reference, not a book reference. So sorry, I know we're a book podcast, but like I'm sure Supernatural has that, especially when they're talking about the Norse gods. There's a whole episode about how the gods are not like... Oh, no, it's Roman gods as well. Because there's Loki in this episode for some reason. And then there's like a forest god and that people don't believe in it anymore. So it starts to murder people. But yeah, stuff like that. So I think it's quite a trope. Yeah. Maybe Terry Pratchett came up with it. I don't know.
Or indeed, probably. But also, I guess it is a part from history and, more history, I guess, because it's the whole thing is it's related to whoever is in power and has the writing and can sort of control that belief in a way.
Yeah.
Like you saw that with, what was his name? That ancient Egyptian pharaoh, Akhenaten? No. The one who was then like, there's only one God. This is when we need Stephanie, who's the host of one of our fellow shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Ramses. She's got to be a Ramses.
I'm pretty sure it started with A. It's the one that they were, the site that they were digging in Crocodile on a Sandbank, the book by Elizabeth Peters. Amun?
Oh. This is so annoying.
I thought
right
it was
there.
Akhenaten.
It probably is an Akhenaten.
I thought it was Akhenaten. There's Egyptologists listening in just screaming at us. This is a very
Akhenaten.
Typical this is a very typical example to show you why we as archaeologists sometimes roll our eyes when people come to us and go, oh, you're an archaeologist. What's your favorite Egyptian pharaoh? I don't know. I don't study Egyptology.
No, I was actually doing a quiz the other day and there was like which Cleopatra was which, and there was Cleopatra I and Cleopatra II, and like I was like it's two, I think. But then I got another one wrong about a different... It was like, oh, what was the Ptolemaic dynasties? Which pharaohs were in the Ptolemaic dynasty? I was like, well, obviously Ptolemy. But then I was like, oh, Cleopatra. But then I got the other ones wrong and everyone was like, you should know this. I was like, should I?
Why?
I'm Neolithic Britain. I don't know. Why would I know this?
Why would I know this? Exactly. Yeah, no, I have absolutely no idea when it comes to Egyptology. Anyway, apologies, Stephanie, who's host of the Past Macabre, if you're listening in. You're probably shouting it at us as well. Anyway, point being, there was this god in ancient Egypt, whatever his name was. I'm pretty sure it's Akhenaten, but I can't remember.
It is Akhenaten, thank you.
Oh, there you go, there we go, there we go. Awesome. Yes, sorry. Well, let's just...
Wait,
yes,
hang on.
Clearly
yes.
The god Akhenaten.
Yes, it was an Akhenaten, I
obviously,
believe.
Obviously Akhenaten.
Don't tell me which one, because I couldn't tell you, but there you go.
Oh, anyway. But yes, he basically decided that there was only one god, and it was the sun god, rather than the whole pantheon of gods that had been done before. But when he died, or sort of lost power in his way, they reverted, and in order to make sure, because that was seen as so sort of disrespectful to the gods and everything, and so they actually like got rid of his name on everything, like on all the temples and all the stele and everything. You can see his name's been like scratched out, so they tried to sort of just eradicate him from history because of the way that he tried to change beliefs.
Yeah, and I suppose a lot of the time you find that belief and faith and gods, especially in landscapes, are symbiotic with the new religion that comes in.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You see it with, like, I think there's a temple of Asclepius in, it's probably Athens. And I remember
when... I was about to say, it sounds like Greece.
Yeah, definitely Greek. But basically, it became a Catholic church because when the Ottomans came in, then they took over that temple. But because Asclepius is very similar to Jesus, it was a very easy transition for the local people that still were still polytheistic. So yeah, and then it sort of changes over. And then it goes back and then it comes back and forth and back and forth. But yeah.
Yeah. That's actually, you see that a little bit also in the Discworld in some places, because you have certain places being built on top of places that were previously sacred, but they do it in almost a kind of satirical way, you know, so it'll be like a cinema complex built on top of an ancient site, but then people start going to the cinema complex and getting like obsessed with it and like praising the stars and all of this kind of stuff. And it's sort of, and actually when the newspaper starts up, Lord Veterinary visits the site and is going, I'm just always a bit, you know, a bit worried when someone starts a new enterprise and there's going to be all sorts of monsters from the other worlds breaking through the planes of, you know, existence and eating us. So, you know, let me just check, you know, has anyone gotten like this person involved who's like some wizard? And, you know, maybe this slab was taken from the ruins of an ancient temple. And he's going like, no, my brother made it for me. And he's like, okay, but even now there may be ghosts haunting our place. He's like, look, I don't know what you're trying to do. But like, so it's, there's definitely an awareness, I guess, of that concept coming through either from the author or from the characters. Who knows? Maybe they just have a mind of their own and Terry Pratchett didn't actually know anything about that. It was just the characters.
No, he must have.
He must have.
Like, clearly he has a lot of... I would actually love the idea that, you know, in our society now, like, you know, some archaeologist, a commercial archaeologist got called in and was like, yeah, we're going to get rid of this mound because it's going to be a cinema, which completely could happen.
Yeah.
And then people are like, oh yeah, like I'm really into like the Neolithic right now. Like, you know? Like, oh yeah, I want to like just articulate my family members when they die and like put them into different mounds. Like that would be... Yeah, exactly. I would just, that's just fantastic.
But yeah, anyway, going back to your original question, original point about the gods and about belief, it also varies per country. Like you have the different countries, which I sort of briefly mentioned last episode as well. So you have like Überwald, where all the vampires and everything live, and the kind of Clachians as well in Jingo, which is a very good one. It's like a complete satire of war and basically shows how stupid war is as a concept. The Clachians are kind of, like I mentioned, based on the sort of Arabian Peninsula. And so there's a lot of overt racism from Ankh-Morpork, which is the kind of, yeah, Edinburgh / London / big UK city equivalent, and about the Clachians, but it's sort of showing how stupid that racism is, you know, and how...
When was that wrote?
Oh, that is a good question. Let me just pause.
Was it like in the early 2000s or was it earlier than that?
I think it was earlier than that.
Oh, that'd be interesting because know what was going on politically at the time. Because it sounds just so current. It sounds
1997.
Very current. Oh, so yes. This was what, Iran?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably when that was all start hitting off and everything. Yeah, so that makes sense, right? With then it also being...
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Like Middle Eastern country, like Arabian Peninsula countries. So yeah, it's like a lot of...
A commentary on how ridiculous it all is. Yeah.
Like they have these two watchmen, Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs, who are like the comic duo of the watch.
Corporal Nobbs. I'm gonna be added into my weapon arsenal of like insults. You're a Corporal Nob.
Oh, it's a good insult because he is. Yeah. But they're sort of having his chat and, you know, Colon's going like, oh yeah, but you know, they didn't even, they're so stupid over there, you know, in Clash. They invent, you know, all sorts of weird things that aren't even useful to anyone, you know, and everything. It's like algebra. And he's like, oh, and Corporal Nobbs is going, oh, wow, that's quite smart of them. And he's going, yeah, but it's not useful. Like, you know, and they did like alchemy and stuff. And he's going, oh, wow, that's amazing. And he's going, yeah, no, it's not. Like, it's real. And it's like, I met someone who said that they invented nothing. And it's like, what? They invented nothing. Yeah. The number zero, nothing. Like, oh, and he's like, oh, anyone can do that. Yeah, right. You know, and stuff. And it's, you know, so it's sort of showing all of this. Yeah. And like they're saying, oh, wow, you know, you have this fancy new telescope like that only came out last year. And he's like, no, this is my great grandfather's, you know. And stuff. And like, yeah. So showing the differences in technical development and all of
which historically kind of and archaeologically has always been the way.
Exactly.
The
yeah,
West has so always never always quite known anything.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I found
like
that
Henry VIII went rolling around not understanding the meaning of zero.
Yeah, right.
But at the same time, the Aztecs, they knew exactly what was going on.
Well, and the technical developments that were happening in like the Arabian Peninsula and, and Asia were like incredible and way earlier than anything that happened in the West. So yeah, it's definitely referred to a lot in those names. But yeah, and then you have, but I mean, and that's also, so that shows the kind of racial prejudices and different racial histories and everything. But then you also do, of course, have the different species. So I already mentioned like the dwarves and the trolls, and they have this kind of longstanding that stems also from kind of legends and myths. And it's just kind of built up and up and up and up and become now this kind of modern day assumption that like, if you're a troll, you have to fight a dwarf. And if you're a dwarf, you have to fight a troll. Like it's sort of what happens. But then you have this really interesting, so in Thud, which is another one of my favorites, spoiler for Thud. So basically it turns out that like the kings of both species were kind of playing this game and wanted to have a peace treaty and everything. And they left actual physical remains of themselves. And that became a whole new lore. So people visit this cave and they can see the remains of the kings basically playing the game of Thud, which is Shuffle, the Viking chess game. Do you know it?
Yes, I do. I just didn't expect you to say Hnefatafl. I really thought you were going to say, like, I don't know, chess.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like it's like the Viking version of chess, right? Like,
yeah. I just wasn't expecting Hnefatafl to appear. That's amazing.
I mean, if you want, you know, do you want to have a quick game of Thud?
Oh, I'd love that. Well, you might have to teach me the rules.
Yeah, that's fine. I can do that. Okay.
That was a great game.
Well, you know, beginner's luck. Anyway, what were we talking about before we had that?
I had Hnefatafl and I just beat you at Thud, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway. Well, I guess that kind of leads on nicely to the topic of material culture, which, of course, is our favorite.
Oh, it is our favorite.
In any of these things. And I think that's probably the most interesting thing about the Discworld archaeologically, for me at least, because there's so much, like so many references, again, to entanglement, to so many different post-processual theories about objects having their own agency, as we talked about with the golems in episode one. And like, so for example, with the dwarves, seeing as we're on the topic of dwarves.
Wait, I need to guess. So you said they were small because of the mines?
Yes.
Okay, I'm guessing, like every other dwarf, they have axes.
They do.
Okay, fantastic. Do they have, like, some sort of, I don't know, like, battle armor or something like that as well? Do they use, like, oars,
well,
you know, metal?
They do. Well, so what's actually really fascinating about dwarves is that they're all male. Not biologically, but socially. They're all male. So every dwarf has like a thick bushy beard and wears like full-on chainmail and helmets and everything. And so courting in the dwarvish world is quite a diplomatic affair because you have to sort of work out who the person is. But then I also find that quite interesting. And there's actually a character called Sergeant Cheery Littlebottom.
Cheery Littlebottom.
Cheery Littlebottom, yeah.
Cheery.
Cheery.
They have a cheery little bottom.
Like Cheery Littlebottom. which is, that is a great scene. There's a whole scene where like she's, well, so, oh, spoiler. He is first meeting Commander Vimes and he's like, oh, what's your name? Cheery Littlebottom. And it's like, yes, you know, the dwarf seemed to be waiting for something. And you know, all right, yeah, nice, excellent, great, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And like goes really normally through the thing. And the dwarf's going, you did hear my name, didn't you, sir? And he's going, yeah, it's written here, Cheery Littlebottom. And he's going, oh, okay, oh, all right then, you know, and then leaves the room. And then it's like, you know, Vimes went to the door, shut it, put his head underneath a blanket, and then you could just hear muffled laughter, you know, throughout the room going, Cheery little bottom. but he, it turns out, is a she, and she starts to like really show that she's a she. So she wears like steel cap boots, but with a heel and like a leather skirt rather than leather kind of trousers, and will add like a little bit of lipstick, you know, under her helmet and everything. And that, for that, she is like very, oh, what's the word? Sort of almost attacked by other dwarves, not
so
physically, but like
ostracized.
Ostracized, yeah, very much ostracized. Until in one spoiler, in, I think it is in Thud, actually, the king of the dwarves shakes her hand, and that like leads to a whole like, what? Like, you know, the king shook the hand of a, you know, outward female, like amazing, you know, and that sort of starts a whole kind of revolution thing, but it's still seen as a little bit of a, ooh, you know, if you're out as a female dwarf, you know, that's kind of like a big deal sort of thing. So anyway.
Because you could easily play into gender archaeology there.
Right. Yeah.
How we look at material culture, how we sex material culture.
Exactly.
Also, yeah. You can look at the society itself and understand the gender politics that's going on there and what that means and why it's more important to present as male than female.
Yeah.
That's like a very deep.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is what I mean. There's so many, like I say, because of that, everyone archaeologically, I guess, people would be like, oh, yes, this is clearly a male because he's got, you know, an axe, which it's an axe with an axe on one side and a pickaxe on the other, because I think the quote's something like, because the pickaxe, because you want to, you know, sometimes you find yourself in a situation where you need to hack some precious stones out of a rock. And then the axe is because the people who own the rock can be so unreasonable sometimes, you know. But yeah, so it's, yeah, that's sort of a very, and what I really love is there's one, it's in one of the ones that involves the dwarves in sort of a lot of detail in any case, because you also have this whole sort of different part of the schisms, lots of schisms within dwarvish society. And one of the schisms is the deep downers or the grags, who are kind of like the holy men and they're revered. But then there's sort of one branch of them that goes a little bit wild and basically claims that like no dwarf should ever be above ground and like everyone should be male and, you know, you're being undwarvish if you believe all these things, which I also find really fascinating. It's really strongly related to a lot of kind of indigenous archaeology in that way, because there's a lot of dwarves who now live in Ankh Morpork, in the towns and in the cities, and they are friends with trolls and all this kind of thing. And there's this one book that's talking about it, and they're talking about how so many of them are feeling this guilt of like, I am not dwarvish enough because I am, you know, acting in this way and all this kind of stuff, which I thought is so fascinating, because that I hear a lot when I was reading up about kind of indigenous experiences in relation to understanding your heritage and things. So, you know, you obviously have a lot of indigenous communities who are now have moved to cities and have moved sort of away from their land and, you know, that kind of thing, because most of the time they were forced to. But then a lot of the youth then that are growing up, for example, the Inuit in Canada, when I was doing my PhD, I sort of was reading a lot about this for one of my studies that I was doing, and also just chatting a lot with Inuit communities in Montreal and in Ottawa. And there's this disconnect with your Inuit heritage and who you are as a person living in kind of a southern city, you know, in Canada. And yeah, I found it quite interesting. You sort of almost, you can see a little bit of a sort of reference to that very complicated issue in this kind of thing, which I think is also something that's really deep to get into in these.
So do the dwarves have that kind of, like, have they been colonialized in that way? Like, do they have the same sort of,
no, like, so that's the difference, obviously. No. Is that, yeah, they haven't been forced in that way, but it's still that kind of that identity, that question of identity. Mm-hmm. And how do you connect with your heritage and how do you connect with your culture, which I find really fascinating. And I dislike that reference, because I think obviously archaeology, we deal with stuff that's in the past, but there's so much of it that is related to things in the present, like
impacted today. Yeah.
Yeah. Like identity and all, it's, you know, cultural identity. And I think that's such a big issue now in the modern day as well. Right. Like, for, you know, how do we identify ourselves? Do we have national borders? We have, you know, all of these very stupid ideas of cultural identity, in my opinion, like, you know, which is what causes a lot of these things. And yeah, like big nationalism and things like that. And I think that a lot of that stems from that. And that's also why archaeology is so important, because it shows where that has all come from and like how we relate to that, which I think is, yeah. Anyway, that was.
Yeah, and how we see it today as well, definitely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So do the dwarves have their own language, or do they speak?
They do.
The same. So they do. So they, what do they speak?
They speak, well, it's called Dwarvish, but yeah, and it's sort of, it's very kind of, there's a lot of K's and Z's, and it's like, like when it's in the audiobook, it's very kind of and stuff, like it's sort of quite, you know, intense.
But then do they speak Uberwaldian when they're above ground?
Yeah, so if they're in Uberwald, they'll speak Uberwaldian. If they're in Ankh Morpork, they'll speak Morporkian, which is like English, basically.
And does anyone speak Dwarvish in the cities.
Like, yes.
Apart from, yes, they
do. Yeah, so like Commander Vimes can speak some Dwarvish. And actually what's funny is you have Captain Carrot, who was raised in a Dwarvish mine, but he's like a 6'5", like really strapping watchman with like bright red hair, and that's why he's called Carrot. But
I'm going to say that as like, does he have red hair?
Yeah, he was raised as a dwarf. And that's also a really funny thing that they talk about all the time, because it's like, well, I have undergone all of the rituals of dwarvishness. Like he is at some point saying, he's like, I have done the karapacha and I have walked the hatachapa, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, yes, of course, I'm not the right height maybe, but does that not, like, am I not a dwarf? Like, because I, you know, so it's sort of that nature versus culture thing as well, which I find really fascinating.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going into that. But yeah, my main thing with the going back to material culture with the dwarves, there's one section about the axe and they're talking about, okay, so massive spoiler for The Fifth Elephant, which is one of the books.
Oh,
so if you're into that, don't talk about that. And this is also about, this is about the crowning of the new king of the dwarves. And in order to be crowned, you have to sit on the scone of stone, which is a reference, of course, to the stone of scone, which is the Scottish thing. But because in dwarfish, in dwarfish history, you have, in dwarfish society, you have bread is like, can be baked. Dwarfish bread is like, it's edible, but it's sort of inedible. And you can use it as like battle weaponry and stuff. And so there is a scone, which has like raisins in it and stuff, which is like the throne.
He really read Lord of the Rings and he was like, I'm going to use that.
Right. It really is.
And it's like, was like, yeah.
It's something like dwarvish bread can last you for days. You know, you can last for days off a single crumb of dwarvish bread because you look at it and think, my God, I'd rather eat anything apart from that. But yeah, and so you have this scone, but basically it goes missing and then there's this whole thing and Commander Vimes gets involved and is sort of helping to try and find it and everything. But it turns, so big spoiler, people who don't want to know things, please go ahead. It basically turns out that the original scone was disintegrated down, like they made it into crumbs, and then so that the new king couldn't be crowned on it. But then they just baked a new one. And there's like this scene at the end where like they have the, someone accuses them and it's like, that's not even the real scone. And then they have like the oldest dwarf who's like the one that's really respected and revered and knows all the lore and everything. And it's like, he will know. And so he comes up and he tastes it. And then there's like a moment and Vimes knows that it's not the real one. So he's going like, oh my God. And then he says like, yep, no, this is, you know, this is the stone, the real stone, the real scone and nothing but the scone, you know, sort of thing. And it's like, oh, what? And then he talks about the to the king about it afterwards. And he's like, well, yeah, it's a scone. Of course, it's not gonna like last, you know, thousands of years. You know, it has to be rebuilt. And he's like, but what about all of the stuff and everything? And he brings out his axe, the king brings out his axe, and he's like, this is the axe of my great-great-grandfather. Sure, it's had to have a handle replaced every so often. At some point there was a big dent in the axe head, so that had to be replaced. This had to be done to this. But is this not the axe of my great-grandfather? You know, which I just thought was such a fascinating, what a, you know, great thing, like, just because, like, and that just shows materially, like, the chemical physical properties of the object are so removed from like the actual concept of the object in a way, like the, anyway, sorry, I got very into
the significance in everything. No, you're totally right, it is absolutely, it's the Mary Rose, isn't it? It's like, how much can you actually rebuild of that ship until it's actually not the Mary Rose anymore?
Exactly. Uh-huh. But then it's anyway, I remember when I first read that sentence, I was like, oh,
this is archaeology.
So yeah, you have a lot of that kind of referencing of things, and there's definitely a lot of respect of material culture and a lot of relevance to that. You also have a lot of like magical objects that kind of push the story forward and the history forward, right? They're like, for example, like there's in this one called Soul Music, which is one of the ones in the Death series, you have this like harp/guitar, and it's basically about rock music and rock bands and everything. But there's this harp/guitar, which is kind of magical, and it's that which sort of pushes the story forward, because every time someone plays that, it turns into this like huge rave and no one can remember what happens afterwards. Like, but that sort of creates this whole then like momentum and this whole like rock culture and everything. And then you have like a trophy cup in Unseen Academicals, which is the one about football. And that also like prompts the idea of football to come into play. And it's like the goddess of football. And there's like this whole thing. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff as well, where you have objects being actually like the background driving force almost of the story.
That's mad. You know, there's something about the harp guitar that feels mythical. There's something, is that not in a myth, but like something where I'm thinking like folklore, like you dance with the fae, you dance till you drop.
So like, that is the character who plays it is from Llamados, which is very obviously based on Wales. And like everyone from Llamados is essentially musical and can sing beautifully and like all this sort of stuff. And so he's an elf from Llamados. And like, yeah, he comes in and is doing all this stuff. But yeah, so I can definitely, I think there is definitely a reference to that sort of mythology.
That's so funny though, because like as someone who has literally read two Terry Pratchett books, you can pick out what he's talking about even from, if you have any, like if you have knowledge of myth or of archaeology, of history or anything, you can pick out the things that he's referencing really easily. That's skill for a writer. That's insane.
And it also just goes to show, which is something we were talking about with The Witcher as well, right? Like in the last few episodes, that if you have that buildup of the history of the world, like that's what makes fantasy worlds incredible. And because it has that history and that believability and being able to just randomly reference some mythological thing or some like ancient site or, you know, something like that, that's what makes it more, not believable, because obviously it's a fantasy world, but you know what I mean? Like more acceptable.
It's tangible to the reader.
Tangible, yes.
As well. Good, like you can understand it. You can see yourself in it. And that makes you read it. That makes you become a huge fan like Tilly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just a casual
reader.
Where
it becomes an encyclopedic knowledge, you know, of a world that does not exist, but is very similar to our own in many ways.
I mean, there is no archaeology of Discworld that has been written yet.
I'm just saying, I think we should start saving. So I think you should really...
I mean, there's a whole Science of Discworld series, which basically deal with... It's actually quite clever because it's not talking about like the science behind things that happen in the Discworld. It's talking about real life science, but it's using the Discworld as a kind of case study to show how it's not working that way in the Discworld. Why isn't it working that way in the Discworld? And why does it work that way in the real world? Like, it's sort of a really cool setup with that. And so in that one, they kind of reference archaeology.
Do you know, I'm so surprised that it hasn't been turned into a game.
As in Discworld?
Yeah, like an actual like computer game.
Oh, computer. You know what? I think there might be a computer game actually.
But like what, like an RPG? If this was an RPG, it'd be so dense.
It would be very dense.
Wade like through a proper, it.
Yeah.
Imagine they making have, your character. Like
they
character
definitely have a couple
alone.
Of board games about it. Which are sort of playing characters, but yeah.
But imagine on an RPG game, right? Yeah. Where you're actually walking through these cities and these places.
Oh my God, that'd be amazing. That might get me into computer games. Like
you actually would. You'd be like,
I'd be like,
I'm
studying
now.
Gamer. Like,
I don't know how to use this computer.
What is this thing?
But like, I'm surprised it hasn't become something like that, because it is on the same scale as The Witcher, as Lord of the Rings, as only all these big fantasies. So why hasn't it become something like that?
I think because it's a comedy. Like, it's comedic, and so people don't take it as seriously. So it's also not seen as, like, serious literature by a lot of people. Whereas, like, obviously Lord of the Rings is seen as, like, the ultimate, you know, serious fantasy book. And even The Witcher, it's sort of, it's popular, but it's very, it deals with a lot of intense themes. The Discworld deals with those themes as well, but because it does it in a satirical way, in a comedic way, I think that comedic fantasy is very underappreciated by, not by people who love it, but by, you know, critics or the general people who think something is worth funding, you know? Like,
I think that's interesting. That is, and it is likely true. Yeah. I just think it's a waste. Like, imagine not being able to walk through Discworld to see the turtle, to see all those things, interact with the gods and have all these, because have they ever played D&D?
I mean,
the amount of stuff that happens in that.
I think there's an extreme overlap between people who play D and people who like Discworld.
Exactly. So there's definitely a market for it. If anyone's listening, you know, Larian, if you're listening.
I think actually there might be, now that I'm thinking about it, I think there might be a Discworld RPG, like Discworld Dungeons & Dragons, like manual.
That makes sense. If it was Dungeons and Dragons, it would make so much sense.
Yeah. I think there's like a game, practical game manual, you know, of how to, of doing an RPG set in Discworld. Because I'm pretty sure I either downloaded it or like put it on a wish list at some point.
There is. It's a novel by John M. Ford, Phil Masters, and Terry Pratchett.
There you go. There you go.
Oh, but there's actually, there's a Kickstarter as well going on.
There you go.
Yeah.
That might be the one I'm thinking of.
So maybe that's it as well.
Yeah.
But then it would be, I just can't believe it's not a like a computer game.
I know. But and I think that also ties in quite nicely with the concept of archaeology as well, because I think archaeology is very similar in being one of those topics that people are like, yeah, but it's good fun. And like, sure, we can learn some like fun stuff. But like, what's actually the use of it? Like, it's not serious. It doesn't deal with modern day, you know, issues and everything. And I think that it's then the perfect analogy for why archaeology and history and the arts are also underfunded, because it's something that is not seen as having like some sort of critical benefit, but it is.
It's yeah, that's, isn't it bollocks?
Right.
Like, yeah. It so totally is. I mean, many of the things that we see and experience today wouldn't be happening if someone had just learned a little bit more about what happened in history, I feel.
Yeah.
So right. I think you can see it. And I think a lot of historians and archaeologists see these patterns that constantly happen. We're just like, come on, just fund us and we'll tell you.
We'll tell you why this shouldn't be happening.
We'll let you see the truth of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know what, Tilly, I think our archaeological survey of the Discworld is complete. Although I fear we've only scratched the surface.
I mean, honestly, I could do a whole series on the archaeology of the Discworld.
Tilly, we are absolutely not becoming a Discworld podcast.
Oh.
I'm sorry. You can do that with someone else.
I am thinking of writing, after we've had this episode, I'm now like, maybe I should just write an archaeology of the Discworld.
You absolutely should. I mean, I'll read it. I'll support you.
Excellent. Okay, there you go. Well, if anyone wants to, please get in touch and say that you'll back me. I could do a Kickstarter. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's about it for this episode of Am I Trowel. We hope that you enjoyed this archaeological survey. I certainly did. As always, please do like, subscribe, follow wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps support the show. And if you're interested in hearing more archaeology content, you can check out the other shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network. For this one, you'll find all the contact info plus the links and further reading on today's discussion in the show notes.
Tilly, why is there a clay dragon flittering about my head? Is this something to do with Discworld?
No. I meant to talk to you about that. I think that we might have to get a little bit of help for this one.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.